Now, from the WMAL WinBet Studios, the Saturday Morning Update.
Well, Merry Christmas. It is the Saturday Morning Update. I'm Rick Fowler. Merry Christmas to Jeff Wolf and Merry Christmas to Jane Houghton with us this morning. Very glad you've joined us. It is Christmas of 2021, another Christmas impacted by COVID, and we all remember what happened last year, and awkward if you tried to see your family. Many people didn't. Could have a little bit of that going on again this year with the spread of the Omicron variant. And we're going to talk a little bit about the Biden administration, its handling of this variant, and some of the things that have come out of the administration this week. Also, Build Back Better is not working out so well, and we're going to have the very latest on that for you this morning. And we will be talking today with, of course, Jennifer Harper from the Washington Times, and we'll look into some of the Christmas trends, what's going on with holiday shopping, and also some interesting historical perspectives on Christmas with Jennifer. Jim Trusty will join us. He's our legal expert, of course, and a couple of developments this week on the legal front. Of course, the conviction in Minnesota of Officer Kim Potter, two counts of manslaughter. She is in jail over this Christmas weekend. That in the accidental shooting death of Daunte Wright, that verdict came in. The Durham probe continues very quiet, but that is very much alive. And Jim will have the update for us on some developments this week in the probe by John Durham, of course, of the accusations of Russian involvement in the Trump campaign, that whole mess. We're going to be talking with John Gizzi this morning. He'll have some historic looks back on Christmas, and also we'll get the very latest on Build Back Better from John. Three more Democratic congressmen and women have decided not to run again in 2022. We'll tell you who they are, but that's 23 defections now among the Democrats for re-election. So not going so well for the president, unfortunately, these days. And, you know, it's getting to the point that in the last 12 hours or so, overnight, there was a big story out of Vanity Fair, which is about the last place you would expect to see somebody critical of President Biden, is Vanity Fair, because they're very, very much against the Republicans typically and have attacked Donald Trump over the years. And it has to do with the test kits. There's a lot of talk going on about the test kits and why we don't have enough test kits in this country. And there apparently was an opportunity last fall that the Biden administration could have ordered test kits, and it didn't happen. And here's what Vanity Fair is reporting. It says the Biden administration turned down a COVID-19 mass testing plan in late October. Experts in the meeting called for 732 million rapid at-home tests to be produced and distributed per month. They expected a holiday surge, but White House officials said that test manufacturers did not have the capacity. The Biden administration turned down the plan in late October that had been laid out by COVID-19 testing experts to manufacture and send over 700 million rapid COVID-19 at-home tests to Americans ahead of the holiday. That story will probably percolate over the weekend, and when Vanity Fair turns on the Biden administration, things are getting worse, as you'll be seeing and hearing about that. We do want to bring you up to speed on some of the audio from the week, because many people running around at the last minute, not paying strict attention to the news, but there were some developments that kind of set the tone for Build Back Better, where it goes next. It all started on Sunday. Joe Manchin was on Fox News Sunday with Bret Baier, and Bret was asking him about his vote on Build Back Better. And this is what Joe Manchin had to say when he said, "This is a no about Build Back Better.
If I can't go home and explain it to the people of West Virginia, I can't vote for it. And I cannot vote to continue with this piece of legislation. I just can't. I've tried everything humanly possible. I can't get there."
You're done. This is a no.
This is a no.
Well, that was the shot heard around the world on the Sunday talkers. Once that news broke, it was all over Meet the Press and Face the Nation. So how did the White House spin this? Well, here's what Jen Psaki had to say about it in a press conference.
We have been working with Senator Manchin for months now. The president has known him for years. Many of the White House senior staff have known him for years as well. It doesn't mean that there aren't moments of disagreement or frustration. Of course there are. This is legislating. That's the nature of sometimes how it gets done. But our objective and our focus now is moving forward.
So that's how Jen Psaki explained it in the White House briefing room. The president did an interview with David Muir on Wednesday, of course, ABC World News Tonight, and he was asked about it, and this is how David Muir asked the president about Build Back Better and Joe Manchin.
You've met with Senator Joe Manchin a number of times. You invited him to your home in Delaware. He came to the White House a week ago. Then he's on Sunday morning cable and says, I'm a no.
Well, look,
how does that happen? How are you not able to close the deal?
Well, look, let's talk about what we have done. We have passed more major legislation than anybody in their first year ever, 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 ever. Now, I haven't given up on this. I haven't given up on it.
But Senator Manchin's main sticking point, it would appear, is the child tax credit. Are you willing to take that out if it means bringing him on board?
Well, look, I want to get as much as I can possibly get done. As much as we can possibly get done. I still think we'll be able to get a significant amount of what we need to get done, done. Particularly as the American people figure out what is in this legislation. It's extremely consequential.
So I think that gives you a pretty good sense of what's going on with Build Back Better. And we'll have more from the president's interview with David Muir. Also, some of the other missteps, unfortunately, of the administration this week. And that's all coming up. But first, Michelle Murray is in the WMAL Traffic Center this morning.
In Howard County and Ellicott City, be aware of a vehicle fire that has all lanes closed westbound on 70 between U.S. 40 and Maryland 32 to follow police direction there. Earlier accidents on the Beltway Inner Loop at the Greenbelt Road exit at the Goodluck Road overpass has been cleared. You will still find crash activity right now in 95 southbound at the ramp to go onto the Prince William Parkway. That south entrance ramp is still closed due to the crash activity. No other delays or problems to report on 95 from Springfield towards Dale City. Now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
As we move through our Christmas Day, mostly cloudy skies. Can't rule out a chance for a few showers. Dot radar not going to amount to a whole lot with temperatures that will be in the 60s. Winds will be from the southwest at 10 to 15, will likely gust upwards of 20 miles per hour. Partly cloudy for the overnight, dropping out of the 30s. Tomorrow, mostly sunny and breezy. A little bit cooler, middle to upper 50s to around 60. Cooler yet for the day on Monday, with daytime highs only in the upper 40s. I'm 7 News meteorologist Steve Rudin, the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
49 degrees in the nation's capital, 617 on the Saturday morning update.
Washington's Mall, WMAL, where Washington comes to talk.
The Saturday morning update continues, and if you're just waking up, a Merry Christmas to you. I'm Rick Fowler, and we've been looking over some of the sound of the week, a very important interview that the president did with David Muir on ABC. And there's been a lot of speculation about whether President Biden will run for re-election, and what would happen if there were a rematch with Donald Trump? Well, David Muir asked the president about that.
I want to ask you about something I asked weeks before the election when we sat down. You said you would absolutely serve 8 years if elected. Do you plan to run for re-election?
Yes. But look, I'm a great respecter of fate. Fate has intervened in my life many, many times. If I'm in the health I'm in now, if I'm in good health, then, in fact, I would run again.
And if that means a rematch against Donald Trump?
You're trying to tempt me now. Sure. Why would I not run against Donald Trump for even the nominee? That would increase the prospect of running.
Would increase the prospect of running. Okay. Another interesting clip from President Biden this week, and you may have heard that the vice president said this week that the administration didn't see the Delta variant coming. Well, David Muir asked the president about that.
The vice president said in recent days that you didn't see Delta coming, you didn't see Omicron coming. How did you get it wrong?
I would get it wrong. Nobody saw it coming. Nobody in the whole world. Who saw it coming?
That's pretty pathetic. He's picked up that laugh from Kamala Harris. So, when the going gets tough, the weak start laughing. Jen Psaki had to deal with that same question in the White House briefing room.
Why is the president saying about this new variant, nobody saw it coming, nobody in the world, if that's not true?
Well, first I would say that nobody knew that there would be the number of different variants. Nobody knew exactly how transmissible they would be. We, of course, knew that there would be additional variants at some point coming. We didn't know what they would look like.
So we just mentioned a few minutes ago the story that came out late last night from Vanity Fair that the Biden administration turned down the opportunity to the recommendation as well to manufacture 732 million test kits in the fall. Here's an exchange in the White House briefing room from Peter Ducey about test kits.
And about the testing and the contingencies, why is it that you guys are promising 500 million tests next month if you haven't even signed a contract to buy the tests?
Well, we have no concern about the contract being finalized. We're just working to finalize the contracts. We just announced this 2 days ago. But there's no, we don't see any issue or any halt to getting that done and to finalizing that. That's a natural part of the process. What I can tell you, Peter, about the process to date, because I know there's been a lot of questions about this, is that when we saw a surge in demand in Delta, we took additional actions to expand the over-the-counter test market. You may not remember this, but if you look back to the period pre-Delta. Actually, a lot of these testing companies, there was so little demand, they were laying people off around the country and around the world because there was not demand. What the president also did was use the Defense Production Act to invest $3 billion to ensure we were upping the market so the market would have the capacity to produce more tests. And also, as you know, the FDA approved 8 tests. Otherwise, we wouldn't have had the capacity to do what we're doing for January.
And, of course, that's White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki. Well, we've got another gem from the White House Press Secretary. That's coming up next. So do stay with us here on the Saturday Morning Update, and a Merry Christmas to you. 6:22, it is the Saturday Morning Update. It is Christmas, and it's wonderful to have you with us this morning. This was a gem. I mean, you know, it's been kind of a rough year for folks. The inflation is rampant, and we're going to talk about some of the inflation numbers with Jennifer Harper here in a little bit. But you've got inflation on the rise. You've got the gasoline prices on the rise. You've got supply chain issues, so maybe some things you wanted to get for Christmas, you haven't been able to get them yet. But according to the White House Press Secretary, the administration has saved Christmas.
Also, just wanted to note, the president, of course, just met with a number of business leaders and industry leaders about efforts to address bottlenecks in the supply chain. I think you all saw him give remarks on that as well. But as the New York Times said today, Christmas gifts are arriving on time this year. Good news. We've saved Christmas. And that is because President Biden recognized this challenge early, acted as an honest broker to bring key stakeholders together, and focused on addressing practical problems across the global supply chain.
Okay, so that's that. All righty. Well, you know, as we move out of 2021 and we move into 2022, we could all hope for maybe some unity on Capitol Hill. I'm not sure that we're going to see it. Obviously, we're going to see the January 6th investigation continue as the Democrats will, as part of that effort, be doing everything they can to take Donald Trump out of the 2024 race and obviously to diminish any impact that he may have for candidates coming up in the 2022 midterms. So we're going to see that continue. We will see the continued debate over Build Back Better. And we will see, I guess, a turn. I mean, I think we've seen a turn now in many of the major cities around the country where the defund the police movement was such a major effort a year or so ago. And if you were listening last week, we had the clip of the mayor of San Francisco now calling for a police step up in San Francisco with all of the smash and grabs going on in San Francisco. So that was something that was a step in the right direction. Mayor Lightfoot of Chicago, Lori Lightfoot, who has been very much defund the police mayor, is now asking for federal help, and the help she's asking for is more to target guns coming into Chicago, but at least, finally, she is asking for federal help. Now, you may have heard that two Democratic lawmakers were carjacked this week, and the Department of Justice has now announced that they have filed charges against one of the suspects in the carjacking of the Democratic congresswoman, and that's Mary Scanlon, a Democrat of Pennsylvania, a U.S. attorney in Philly, announcing that 19-year-old Josiah Brown of Wilmington, Delaware, has been charged with carjacking and carrying and using a firearm during a crime of violence. It happened at Philadelphia's Franklin Roosevelt Park this week, and the suspect arrested with four others. Now, can you imagine you go out and you're going to carjack somebody and you pick a congresswoman and you end up with federal charges on your back? I mean, how bad was your luck that day? But anyway, that's just some of the news that's been going on throughout the week. And we thought we'd kind of run it down for you because a lot of people are out doing all kinds of different things. You tune out a little bit during the week when you're trying to do all that last-minute holiday shopping, and we thought we'd kind of bring you up to speed on where some of the major developments are. So it is 6:28 now on the Saturday Morning Update.
Washington's Mall, WMAL, where Washington comes to talk.
In the news at 6:30, in Paris, masked worshippers did line up to enter the church across from the Louvre Museum and attend a Christmas Eve Mass. It is the second year of holiday services under the shadow of the virus in France. France has now recorded its highest yet number of daily COVID-19 infections, and hospitalizations have been rising. French government has held off on imposing curfews, closures, or other restrictions for festivities. The holiday scene at the White House has been a little less merry under COVID-19 shadow. The President and First Lady Jill Biden replacing the large parties, the overflowing buffet tables of the past, with food-free open houses, face masks, and testing for the unvaccinated. Vice President Kamala Harris's office says she has tested negative for the coronavirus after having close contact earlier this week with an aide who later tested positive for COVID. And the U.S. will lift travel restrictions on eight southern African countries that it imposed to try to blunt the spread of the COVID Omicron variant. It's 6:31. It's the Saturday Morning Update, and we go to Michelle Murray in the WMAL Traffic Center.
An incident is being reported eastbound on the Intercounty Connector at exit 19B. The exit to go into 95 North, so use caution there. Also in the West Friendship area on westbound 70, just before US 40, the Ellicott City exit, all lanes are blocked due to a vehicle fire, so follow police direction there. So far, traffic is moving well on the Beltway throughout Montgomery County and Prince George's County, and no problems heading into Virginia through the Tysons area all the way in towards Springfield. Now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
As we move through our Christmas day, mostly cloudy skies, can't rule out a chance for a few showers. Dot radar not going to amount to a whole lot with temperatures that will be in the 60s. Winds will be from the southwest at 10 to 15, will likely gust upwards of 20 miles per hour. Partly cloudy for the overnight, dropping out of the 30s. Tomorrow, mostly sunny and breezy. A little bit cooler, middle to upper 50s to around 60. Cooler yet for the day on Monday, with daytime highs only in the upper 40s. I'm 7 News meteorologist Steve Rudin, the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
49 degrees in the nation's capital. Merry Christmas, 6:33 on the Saturday Morning Update.
Washington's Mall, WMAL, where Washington comes to talk.
And a Merry Christmas. This is the Saturday Morning Update on WMAL. Rick Fowler with you. And Jennifer Harper joins us each weekend. She, of course, writes Inside the Beltway at the Washington Times. Good morning and Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas, everybody, and good morning.
So it is Christmas morning. That means holiday gifts. And with inflation this year, with the rise in gasoline prices and energy prices, what does that mean in terms of consumer spending for Christmas? And I figure you've got some information on that.
Well, they're feeling pretty darn good. And this is actually good for the nation, good for everybody. And I got the numbers here from the National Retail Federation, always on top of these matters. And they reveal that Americans will drop an average $997.73. Everybody, to buy all those Christmas and holiday gifts this year. And they also noted that 90% of Americans plan to celebrate Christmas and Kwanzaa this year. And here's a breakdown on that spending. $648 goes towards the gifts. $231 goes towards decorations, greeting cards, food, and candy. And another $118 for miscellaneous purchases of the season. And they're just saying a very good season for sales. Despite all the public health issues and everything else that's going on, uneasy politics, well, everybody went out and did some good spending. And here's what their statement is at the National Retail Federation. They say 2021 holiday season appears to be on track to exceed the National Retail Federation's forecast for record spending despite supply chain disruptions, inflation, and challenges like the new COVID-19 Omicron variant. Again, that's coming from Jack Kleinhans. He is the chief economist at the National Retail Federation. So, well, good job, everybody.
Everyone may be voluntarily spending a little more money on holiday gifts this year, but involuntarily, they're also spending more money at the grocery store. What does that mean for Christmas dinner?
Well, yes, Biden inflation, or Bidenflation, I should be saying, that did hit Christmas dinner. And, oh, boy, there's some real fancy numbers on this one. But Americans in general, as probably all our listeners know, have endured some very high prices. They endure them at Thanksgiving dinner, and now it's with Christmas dinners as well. The price of Christmas dinner, and this is according to Mintec. This is a London and New York-based data and analytics group. Gosh, I can hardly get that out. They're focused on food and manufacturing brands. And this is what they have to say about Bidenflation. Their U.S. Christmas dinner index indicated an upward movement in the run-up to Christmas amid rising key commodity prices. And they are deeming this cost a record high. So U.S. consumers in general are paying 15.4% more than they did a year ago for all the typical items that we love at our holiday dinners. That includes a 14.2% rise in the price of all the primary stuff like turkey or your beef or pork, potatoes, carrots, the dinner part of it, and a 35.8% in all the stuff that went into the desserts with like flour, sugar, butter, eggs, spices like dinner. And also the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, they also revealed that the cost of all alcoholic beverages have increased by 1% compared to a year ago. And our friends over at the Los Angeles Times say that this is nothing more than booze-flation. So there you go for your meal report today.
You mentioned setting a record in there. Well, President Biden is setting records, but not the type he wants to have. He is tied with former President Trump at being at the basement in approval ratings at this time in their presidency. Only two presidents this low, and President Biden is one of them. And many of those polls are continuing to drop.
Well, you know, there have been a ton of polls out there, all confirming exactly what you said, and it's kind of like, oh, dear time over at the White House. But I chose one that you would think would be friendly towards the White House, at least the poll might be, but it's not. This is a poll coming from NPR, PBS NewsHour, and the Marist poll, and they have revealed that President Biden's favorability has hit a historic low. That's their word. It's a historic low. And I'm just going to give you some of the numbers here and let the poll do the talking here. And in terms of all overall, Americans, 55% now disapprove of the job that Mr. Biden is doing. Of course, some disapprove more than others. Let's go down that list really quickly. 95% of Republicans disapprove, 66% of independents, and 11% of Democrats, along with 65% of Latinos. That's a very important voting block, by the way. 56% of whites, that is their word, and 52% of non-whites. Also, that's the word used in the poll. And some more disapproval ratings. 71% of rural residents disapprove, along with 57% who live in a small city, 53% who live in a small town, 52% who live in a big city, and 47% who are suburbanites. And in terms of locations around the United States, 67% of those who live in the Midwest now disapprove of Mr. Biden, along with 55% of Westerners, 54% of Southerners, and 45% of those who live in the Northeast. And, boy, all the way down the line, even the Gen Xers, age 40 to 55, 74% disapprove of him now. And I guess the silent generation, that's the folks over 74, they appear to be the most forgiving. They only have a 47% disapproval rating. And, again, this is coming from NPR, PBS, and Marist. And, one other one. Among those who voted for President Donald Trump back in the day, 96% disapprove of Mr. Biden. And only 12% approve. This is a survey of 1,400 adults, and it was conducted December 11 through 13, so it's very current.
Well, let's turn to COVID. Depending on what media outlet you listen to and what doctor you listen to, you might get a different story. What are you finding?
Well, I'm finding some pretty interesting analysis out there because I think a lot of people are just put off by the entire circumstances surrounding it. You get, you know, competing opinions about your health and where you should go and what you shouldn't do. And let's take a quick look. You know, according to Johns Hopkins University, the first case of COVID was reported all the way back on December 1st, 2019. That's the Wuhan, China thing that we all heard about. And this means that the United States and much of the world has been living with this virus for 2 years. And when we go into 2022, very shortly, that's going to be the third year of this medical challenge. And, you know, everybody's noticed that it has influenced politics and social norms, the public security, leisure, all sorts of things, media coverage and so forth. And a very smart guy over at Powerline, the Powerline blog, if you haven't read that, it's very interesting. His name is John Hinderaker. He actually founded this. It's a pretty influential blog. And he is now using the word Omicron mania, meaning that everybody is now getting a mania over Omicron, and what are you going to do? He says, I know I am an outlier, but I have never had real fear of COVID. Some things scare me, like roller coasters, but respiratory viruses are not on the list. But many others don't see it that way, and with the arrival of Omicron, hysteria is making a comeback. Why? He asked. And so he cited, you know, all the things that you see now. Some people are wearing face shields and vinyl gloves and things like that again. And he says, Mr. Hinderaker says, no doubt some of the fear is genuine, but I do think that some people enjoy hysteria. Others prefer to have an excuse to stay home, and some, politicians and liberal activists, enjoy bossing other people around. Very interesting conclusion there from Mr. Hinderaker. He's actually a retired lawyer. He's now president of the Center of the American Experiment. That's a think tank. If you want to find his blog, it's at powerlineblog.com. And interesting words about Omicron mania.
You often have stories about men and women in the service, and you had a really cool one this week about the Coast Guard.
Yeah, I do. I really, you know, feel it's important to recognize people, what they're doing out there, whether it's the Border Patrol or members of our military forces. And today we're going to offer a round of applause for the U.S. Coast Guard Cutter Mohawk. They got home in time for Christmas. They've just returned to their home port of Key West, Florida, after a groundbreaking, that's what they say, 45-day deployment to the Eastern Pacific Ocean. And here's what the Coast Guard has to say in a report they sent to me. The Mohawk team interdicted a low-profile drug smuggling vessel with approximately 3,200 pounds of cocaine aboard and apprehended three suspected narcotics smugglers. These low-profile vessels are purpose-built to evade detection and transport illicit contraband across thousand-mile stretches of ocean. The drugs, worth more than $60 million, were seized in international waters of the Eastern Pacific Coast off of Ecuador. Again, this is coming from the Coast Guard report. While in theater, Mohawk also aided in stopping 17 suspected drug smugglers, contributing directly to the U.S. Southern Command's objectives to combat transnational criminal organizations. And if you're curious about the Hero Cutter Mohawk, it is 270-foot famous-class cutter. And during its time out there, it anchored in the Galapagos Islands. the first of its class to do so, and you got to wonder, a 270-foot boat in the Galapagos Islands makes a mind reel a little bit, but yay for the Mohawk today.
You had a headline in the column this week, President Eisenhower's Historic Christmas Message from Space. Now, we do have to keep in mind that President Eisenhower was in office in the 1950s.
I always like to look at a little historic stuff on Christmas, and this was really kind of apropos since we're all concerned about space and so forth. And let's go back a number of years, and indeed, this has to do with the 34th President of the United States. And to make a long story short, he was the very first person on the planet whose voice was transmitted through space, and it happened in Christmas 1958. Let's go back there. The date is exactly December 18, 1958, when Project SCORE, this was the world's very first communications satellite, it was heaved into space aboard an Atlas rocket and was in a very low orbit over Earth. And this was the first of considered a forerunner and so forth, very important anyway. It was very secretive at the time because, as some will remember, the United States and the USSR were in the middle of a very serious space race and there was lots of clandestine things going on. But anyway, they decided that it was a perfect opportunity to try out this new communication satellite. So President Eisenhower agreed to put out a message, and was a huge deal. And the huger part of it was that it was beamed all over the world so that the USSR could also hear it. But if you're curious, this was what President Eisenhower said December the 19th, 1958. This is the communication satellite had only been in the atmosphere a couple of hours. But anyway, this is what he said. This is the President of the United States speaking. Through the marvels of scientific advance, my voice is coming to you from a satellite circling in outer space. My message is a simple one. Through this unique means, I convey to you and all mankind America's wish for peace on Earth and goodwill to men everywhere. And that is what he said, and it was transmitted all over the world pretty well successfully, and those very words are now part of the National Recording Registry at the Library of Congress. And if you're wondering what the significance was, well, the Smithsonian kind of summed it up for us. They said it proved that satellites could receive signals from one location on Earth and immediately retransmit to another, as well as receive a signal, store it in an onboard recorder, and then transmit on command from the ground. So anyway, that's going back to 1958, and thank you, President Eisenhower, for your Christmas message from space.
Jennifer Harper, inside the Beltway at the Washington Times, you have a very Merry Christmas, and thank you for everything in 2021. Appreciate all of your contributions.
Oh, my pleasure, Rick, and Merry Christmas, everybody. Have a great one.
6:47, Saturday Morning Update on WMAL. Michelle Murray's in the WMAL Traffic Center.
In Calverton, watch out for an accident now in the Intercounty Connector eastbound at 95, where the two left lanes are blocked with that crash. And in Manassas, there is an accident reported northbound on 28 right near Sudley Road. Watch out for lane closures there. The earlier accident in Woodbridge on 95 southbound at the Prince William Parkway, that off-ramp has been reopened. Accident there cleared away, and no delays to report on 95 headed from Springfield in towards Dale City. Now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Mostly cloudy, chance for a few showers. Dot radar not going to amount to a whole lot with temperatures in the 60s. Winds of gusts upwards of 20 miles per hour. Partly cloudy for the overnight, dropping out of the 30s. Tomorrow, mostly sunny and breezy. Middle to upper 50s to around 60. I'm 7 News meteorologist Steve Root in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
49 degrees in the nation's capital, 6:48. It's the Saturday Morning Update and a Merry Christmas. I'm Rick Fowler. Jim Trusty joins us each week. He is a partner at IFRA Law here in Washington, and he is the former chief of the Organized Crime and Gang Section at the U.S. Department of Justice. Jim, good morning.
Good morning and Merry Christmas.
And Merry Christmas to you. Well, it wasn't a very Merry Christmas for Minnesota police officer Kim Potter. A jury found her guilty Thursday of first and second degree manslaughter in the fatal shooting of Daunte Wright. She will be sentenced next year. And Jim, when you look at these two counts, first and second degree manslaughter, your impressions of the jury's verdict?
Well, a bit of a discouraging one, to tell you the truth. I mean, these are very difficult kind of nuanced areas of law where you're trying to draw lines between negligence and gross negligence. And that's really the basic dichotomy when it comes to civil versus criminal. Here you also had a notion called misdemeanor manslaughter, which means that if you commit a misdemeanor, but someone happens to die in the course of that misdemeanor, that you're culpable as if you've committed a regular manslaughter. So these are like bad law school exam concepts. I mean, very tricky concepts for a jury. And unfortunately for Officer Potter in this case, they fell on the line of it being equivalent to gross negligence or recklessness. And I have to say, I don't really buy it. I think this is the first of these high-profile trials we've seen recently where jurors essentially had the facts because they have video, and they have to apply pretty tricky, pretty intricate areas of law. And I think in this case that Officer Potter is certainly guilty of negligence. There could be a wrongful death suit and a big payout to the family. But I'm concerned that this is now being considered criminal culpability and what seems to be a complete mistake by the officer.
Jim, often in these kinds of cases, it's hard to know what the actual facts are because you may have a couple of different eyewitnesses or he said, she said, but here you have video. How did that play into it and how the jury actually processed it?
Yeah, it's a great question because we're really seeing an evolution of the responsibility of jurors. You know, in Rittenhouse, in Arbery down in Georgia, and now this case, all of them had video of the critical moment that was going to be determined to be either lawful or unlawful, whether it was self-defense or, in this case, gross negligence. And I think what's happening is instead of having jurors called upon to assess credibility, where they listen to witnesses and decide, can we believe these witnesses, are they corroborated, they're being given almost the entire fact pattern without dispute. They then have to play kind of baby judges and figure out how does the law apply to these facts. That's a very, I think, a different kind of evolving notion that we're seeing in jurors compared to historically, and I think it's a difficult one.
Officer Potter was sent directly to state prison to await sentencing after the jury reached a verdict. It was 72 hours of deliberations, of course. The Hennepin County District Court judge is Regina Chu. She denied a request from Potter's defense attorney to release her on bail until the sentencing, which is set for February 18th. Is that typical in a case like this, or should she have been allowed to at least go home for Christmas?
Well, I think it was a more of an open issue than Judge Chu made it sound. In fact, the judge initially immediately announced that she was what they call stepping her back, that she was going to have Officer Potter detained pending sentencing. It was only when the defense said they'd like to be heard that they generated a real hearing on the issue. I think it tells you a couple of things. Number one, and probably first and maybe only, that this judge is absolutely going to give some prison time. So I think she looks at the case, she says the person's now been convicted of a high-level felony, a first-degree manslaughter. I'm going to give some amount of jail time, so we might as well start the clock now. I also think perhaps weaving into that analysis by the judge is an actual concern about Officer Potter, because, you know, Potter immediately after the shooting was talking about taking her own life. She's now at a juncture where that really could weigh heavy on her mind. And I think in some ways the judge might think, hey, the safest route I have to keep Officer Potter alive is to actually have her detained at this point. So that tough moment for the defense. I think they had good arguments about how she wasn't going to be a risk of flight, how she'd already posted $100,000 bond, and how she was obviously, you know, showing up when needed. But the judge wants to get on that track towards a significant sentence.
It's been fascinating watching the Jussie Smollett saga with the investigation into the Cook County District Attorney, Kimberly Fox. What is the latest on that angle?
Rick, this is really a discouraging and disgusting moment in criminal justice. There was a special report that was issued by the special prosecutor that handled Jussie Smollett's trial. Part of the mission of the special prosecutor was also to look into the original deal struck by Kimberly Fox's Cook County State's Attorney's Office and Jussie Smollett. And so the special prosecutor conducted 53 interviews, issued about 50 subpoenas, looked at 26,000 documents, and basically said they didn't see any evidence to support a criminal prosecution of the state's attorney, but identified substantial abuses of discretion, and as what they called it, operational failures in resolving the initial Smollett case. And Rick, the original Smollett case still reeks to high heaven. What they did was cut a deal where he agreed to forfeit his $10,000 bond that he had already posted out of really $130,000 of potential restitution. They asked him to do 15 hours of community service, which he spent at a Rainbow Push store helping them sell push gear in Chicago, hardly, you know, cleaning up after horses at the stables. And they even advanced the date of the dismissal by 3 weeks to avoid media scrutiny. So your starting point was an incredibly soft deal. The state's attorney's office interviewees all basically said they were stunned and shocked by the leniency, but nobody would own up to handling the case. In fact, the two prosecutors that actually negotiated the deal each pointed to the other and said that guy or that gal was the lead negotiator. So you have a whole bunch of shaky circumstances. And then you end up having the very specific findings from the special prosecutor about Kimberly Fox. And she lied about a number of incredibly important things, including the fact that she called this a typical alternative prosecution. It was not. There's no precedent for it. She lied about $10,000 being the most she could ever get from Jussie Smollett. That was not true. She even lied, or her office lied, about Smollett having no criminal background when, in fact, he had a DUI conviction that also included, of all things, false information to police. He's been convicted of lying to the cops before, and they held that out and kept that from public scrutiny. And then finally, when the public found out about the deal, Fox lied about the strength of the case. She started to suggest that they cut this sweetheart deal because it was just such a tough case. What I think is the biggest smoking gun and what's going to lead to perhaps some consequences for Kimberly Fox is that she was in contact with Jussie Smollett's sister before he was identified as a fraudster and after. And now she lied about that. She said, oh, I stopped talking to Jussie's sister after I found out that he was now a suspect. Well, the reality is she made a call right after the two brothers, the Osundero brothers, were arrested to Jussie's sister. And she made a call, and I think this is unbelievable in terms of how criminal justice works. She made a call where she told the sister, now that he's a suspect, he should be okay if he remains consistent. I mean, that's the chief law enforcement officer for Cook County essentially coaching his sister to make sure he keeps lying about the assault. To me, it walks right up to the line, at least, for obstruction of justice, although the special prosecutor wasn't quite as offended as I guess I am. And so all of these are findings that I think are pretty solid in fact findings, and they're very damning of progressive prosecutor Kimberly Fox and the way she ran this office.
Well, it kind of sounds like she committed perjury in there somewhere along the way, but what are the repercussions, if any, as a result of the report for Kimberly Fox?
Yeah, probably not going to end up being perjury just because they're not in-court statements that she was making that were dishonest. They're usually to the public. And there's not going to be a criminal case because the special prosecutor, again, didn't think that that question about talking to the sister rose to the level of obstruction. But there will be, and there has been, a referral to the Illinois State Bar. And so the question is going to be whether the Illinois State Bar is offended enough by all of this lying and all of this apparent corruption to take any action against Kimberly Fox. Knowing Cook County and knowing Illinois, I'm not betting my house on this one, but we'll keep an eye on it to see if there's any consequences.
Quick question. If they took action, could she be removed as the DA?
Yeah, if she gets disbarred, she has no ability to hold on to the state attorney's office post.
So let's turn to the Durham probe. We had a couple of indictments. It's been a little bit quiet. Seems like things are pointing up the ladder in the Clinton campaign. What is the very latest, and what do you see as next?
Well, there was a motion filed this week by the special counsel, and it was a motion to inquire about a potential conflict of interest. And it's an interesting phrasing there, which I'll come back to. But it was basically an issue between the special counsel and some attorneys in Washington, D.C., Danny Onorato and Stuart Sears, actually great guys. I know them well, very high-powered, very ethical lawyers. They represent Mr. Danchenko, who was one of the last indictments, the man that was kind of the middleman between the DNC and Richard Steele for the Russian dossier. Another partner in their firm represents the Clinton campaign and some of the individuals within that campaign. So what the special counsel did is said, hey, there's a possible conflict of interest here at some point. And really what they're doing is creating a protective record. They want a judge to weigh in, ask questions, make sure that there's not the sharing of confidential information between parties that might end up being in conflict with each other. In other words, you could have Danchenko pointing to the Clinton campaign and saying they're the ones that introduced falsehood into this process, or vice versa. What's interesting is the motion is not a motion to disqualify, which is where you have a much more aggressive, solid ground basis for disqualifying people on a conflict. It looks to me like this motion reflects a lot of conversation between the defense attorneys and the special counsel, including the fact that even special counsel says, hey, walling off the attorneys within the firm, not letting them communicate about attorney-client privilege might be enough to solve any issue here. So on its face, it's kind of an interesting motion that doesn't really show anything about the big picture. But in describing how there could be a conflict, it tells you a big story, and that is that the Durham probe is alive and kicking. And the Sussman and Danchenko indictments, these two recent indictments, and this language in this motion make it clear that the lawyers and the political operatives for Hillary Rodham Clinton are under the microscope right now.
Well, you mentioned Hillary Clinton. Is there that chance that somehow this could lead all the way up to the top?
There is a chance. I mean, it's hard to tell because, again, the Durham people have been very disciplined about not leaking things or trying to sensationalize their investigation. But, again, the issue is going to come down to a very tricky legal issue, which is, are there conversations that might involve even Hillary Rodham Clinton about this dossier? Even if they're with lawyers, they're not necessarily privileged. And so that is probably the fertile ground that Durham is heading into right now, which is trying to figure out, are there conversations that might have involved Hillary and lawyers, but also third parties? If there's more than a couple of people in the room, that defeats the privilege. Are there conversations where the attorneys are knowingly participating in criminal activity, putting forth falsehoods to the FBI? If that's possible here, then the privilege could be pierced again. So you could end up with incredibly important kind of smoking gun emails, text messages, WhatsApps, or just good old-fashioned conversations that go all the way up to Hillary Rodham Clinton. And Durham will have to figure out, is there a way to break those out of the shell and use them in a court of law for either something like a false statement case or an obstruction of justice case when it comes to the end game of what they did with that Russian dossier?
Jim, thank you for such a detailed analysis of the key stories on the legal front this week. Better than reading like a novel. I mean, this is great stuff, Jim. Thank you so much. Thank you for everything in 2021, and we wish you a very, very Merry Christmas.
Well, thanks so much. The feeling is mutual, and thanks for giving me this platform to have fun with you and talk about these things.
You bet. The news is next on WMAL 7 o'clock.
WMAL-FM, Woodbridge, Washington. The one radio station for you to depend on. All day, every day. 105.9 FM, WMAL. A Cumulus Media station.